Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I remember about 1995, and I went to a electronic music event in San Francisco, and I was, you know, it was sort of the era of Terrence McKenna's mixture up with rave culture, and it was a very high time when these new energies of electronic dance music and psychedelic rave were kind of spilling in and reviving a kind of an American underground scene from coming in from Europe mostly. And I had this great gig where I got to go across the country with Orbital and Aphex Twin on this quote-unquote Monsters of Techno tour. I think it was 1994, actually. And we wound up in San Francisco at the end, where there was already a really booming psychedelic rave culture, part of it instigated by Europeans and particularly Brits, where the sort of lingering West Coast hippie psychedelic vibes were being sort of revived and remixed with these incoming global courses of traveler culture and rave music. And I remember seeing this kid, and he had a young guy, and he had a t-shirt, plain t-shirt. It just said DMT. And I remember at that time, DMT was still, you know, kind of something people just sort of talked about on the side. It was sort of a bit of an esoteric interest. And since I've always been interested in these psychoactive compounds, I kind of approached the guy and I was like, so, you know, what have your experiences been about? And he said, he turned to me and said, oh, I've never tried it. And there's something about the way in which he made an emblem of this thing that he hadn't tried that struck me as sort of very indicative about the weirdness of this particular psychoactive compound, the way this sort of elusive character, the way it's been part of the story and yet unassimilable to the story in some ways, even though, of course, these days in the subsequent 20 plus years, it's become much better known as part of various undergrounds and even of popular culture, and of course as an active component of ayahuasca, which itself has become, you know, not if not quite a household term, then far more mainstream than any of us would have expected even 10 years ago. And so there's something to me that's always been fascinating about DMT, something extra enigmatic, even in the already weird world of psychoactives. And one sign of this is that only last year have we finally gotten a thorough, juicy cultural history of DMT. There's been cultural histories of nitrous oxide, of ketamine, and of course, copious tales of LSD, historical tomes, mushrooms. All of these major compounds have sort of gotten their spin or many spins by cultural historians, anthropologists, people who are looking at these things through a scholarly but open-eyed cleansed lens, let's say. And this book that I'm referring to is Mystery School in Hyperspace, A Cultural History of DMT by Graham St. John. And I only met Graham in person a couple of years ago, but we've been in contact for a very long time. I contributed an article to a essay collection that he put together over a decade ago about rave culture and religion. And Graham is the most important scholar about psytrance and the psychedelic entheogenic side of the global electronic dance music festival. And he's written a number of books on that theme, or a couple of books, Global Tribe and Technomad, both of which are great overviews of raving, full of information. Not only is he a scholar and an anthropologist, but he's also a data hound, and he's got it all packed in there, all the tracks, all the lyrics, all the events. It's a really rich resource. His work is very satisfyingly full as well as insightful. And I can't recommend Mystery School and Hyperspace enough. There's some curious and fun DMT literature out there, but a lot of it is squirrely in one way or the other, and Graham's work is not squirrely, and it's also not dry. And so I really, for anyone interested in these topics, I highly recommend the book. It came out on North Atlantic Press, Evolver Editions, just a couple of months ago, and it's a hefty tome, as Graham puts it, big enough to break open the head. And the tales within it will certainly break open the head. I thought I kind of knew a lot of this stuff, and I was really amazed at the tales and information that and ideas that I gleaned from this work. So it's a great thing, and I'm happy to have Graham on the show. So, Graham, thanks for joining us in Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks, Eric. It's great to be here.
Well, you know, I guess I want to start with that very question that I raised. Why is it, given that there have been cultural histories of other compounds for a long time, or at least within the last 10, 15 years, why do you think it was sort of took so long, not for you personally to write this, although you did a lot of research, but for something like this to happen at all? There seems to be something peculiar and enigmatic about DMT that makes it even harder to kind of grasp for cultural historians and other people trying to think their way through psychedelic culture.
Yeah, it's a very good question, Eric. I guess it really comes down to, or back to the nature of mystery that it evokes and that it exposes the user to. And I should point out at the start that this is certainly not, it's a cultural history of DMT. It's not the cultural history of DMT. So it's not designed to expose the mystery once and for all. But it really is an effort to understand the nature of mystery that the user is exposed to. And I think that, yeah, it's a very fascinating question. Why has it taken this long since the psychopharmacological actions of DMT were discovered in the 1950s? Why has it taken these many decades for us to see a book of this nature? A book that I hope will inspire others to fill in the many, many gaps and perhaps inaccuracies in the book. I think one of ways to answer that question is to recognize that not only does DMT have such profound effects, it has had many, it has worn many hats over its, there are so many scientific angles to approach DMT with, and that's been one of the major sort of stumbling blocks, I guess, for authors and certainly for me. And the fact that I got away with a book that was only 500 pages is quite a mystery in itself. And that range of interpretations, goes from anywhere from the fact that we have a compound that's been that's regarded as a dangerous compound with no medical benefits, to a compound that is regarded as the brain's own very own psychedelic, and in fact a spirit molecule that has profound authentic transformational effects that are even imputed to be produced in the brain's own, human brain's own pineal gland, and thus potentially a source of contact experiences and profound transformational experiences at the start of all religions.
Yeah, I mean that's quite an incredible range. I mean, one of the things that I learned more about it from your book than I had known before was about the early story of DMT, its discovery, and its kind of the sort of, again, somewhat enigmatic role in the counterculture of the 60s and 70s. you know, having read a lot of this literature, having, you know, been interested in contemporary accounts of drug use in that period, one comes across mentions of DMT. People refer to it. They talk about using it. People like Alan Watts and Timothy Leary tried it and indeed produced experience reports. And yet somehow it never, again, kind of wove itself into that particular zeitgeist. You know, LSD is such an important part of that zeitgeist. Other compounds are part of that zeitgeist. But once again, DMT plays this kind of elusive role. But even before then, it sort of again emerges from a lab, et cetera, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about what makes it sort of what it's how its unusual sort of emergence into the modern world as a synthetic compound? Because of course it exists all over the place as a natural compound and is indeed used, you know, ethnobotanically. But just talking about the modern story, what can you say about the way that it emerged into a modern consciousness and then found its way into the counterculture?
Yeah, I think one of the ways to answer that is to understand the dramatic effects of DMT, certainly that which is associated with the so-called breakthrough experience, and how that differentiates from LSD, which so we're talking about a short-lasting, powerful psychoactive effect that for a great many people who've stated that they've experienced a breakthrough event, many have associated that event with an experience of dying. They've associated that with an experience of their own mortality, with an exposure to their own very real sense of dying. And of course, we're not talking about real death here. We're talking about a sort of simulation. And that to me is fascinating. I remember having a conversation with Rupert Sheldrake not so long ago, and I believe you were present there, about this concept of necrotogen, and this concept of a necrotogen being a psychoactive that elicits a feeling that one is dying, or gives one a feeling that one is exposed to the sort of state of mortality, or approaching that, came out of a conversation with Rupert and Terence McKenna back in back probably a year before Terence died, in fact. So I think that this whole notion that DMT enables an exposure to one's own death is one of the reasons why it's become such a black hole substance for many years. But for me, I guess the book is fascinating to me in the sense that it provides an analysis of how DMT has become sort of optimized for even more recreational usages over the last few decades.
Yeah, it's a remarkable transformation of a sort of, you know, enigmatic and disturbing in many ways molecule. I mean, it's very interesting. You go into great detail about the experience of, again, psychedelic luminaries like Alan Watts and Timothy Leary. You know, and they all walk away a bit sort of puzzled, as if this isn't really quite what they're interested in. It's a little alien, it's a little bizarre, and even in their descriptions, particularly Leary's, we find the similar kinds of images and intensities as you find in contemporary experience reports, most of whom are people who haven't read, you know, dug down into Leary's papers to, you know, come up with these descriptions. And it is kind of remarkable the similarity in character of them. But I think what's more interesting is that it seems like something in us has changed, something in culture, something in psychoactive use, something in our mind models that has enabled DMT more room, more sort of greater pasture to nibble through in our own world. And you know, we can talk about that in terms of electronics, and talk about it in terms of information saturation. We can talk about it in terms of, I don't know exactly. And I think that's part of what you're meditating on.
One of the important elements there that I broach in the book, and I think that there's a lot more scope to explore this, is the, of course, the advent of the internet in the 90s, and that was, of course, when Terence McKenna was, who incidentally was exposed to DMT in the fall of 65 in Berkeley, when he had his machine elves in hyperspace experience, and the aftershock of that experience is studied in the book in some detail. But I think in the 90s, we had this, with the advent of the internet, we had this, there's this extraordinary resonance between our experience with cyberspace and the virtual realms of hyperspace, which is essentially the commonly known phrase for the experience of higher dimensions that DMT users are known to access. And I think that by the time of the advent of cyberspace, we had a set of metaphors and analogies to enable us to better articulate that experience. And I know that McKenna was on that in the 90s, and so I think the advent, and of course we can go back to William Gibson's work, and for instance the adventures of Bobby Newmark as a consol cowboy in Gibson's Count Zero, this idea of breaking into the matrix at the earlier literary phase of cyberspace had a lot of resonance with this idea of breaking through into hyperspace, and of course we use that the same phrase hyperspace for digital hyperspace and DMT hyperspace.
And it's not just the kind of changes in culture that have enabled DMT to kind of flourish for all its intensity and challenges in our contemporary world. It's also that people have been working on improving access, on improving the materials, and in fact discovering that you don't need to synthesize it in the laboratory, that you can extract the material from plants. And that's one of the stories you tell, is about this kind of underground research. And again, that itself is a very complicated and difficult to report story, because a lot of it's in the underground, a lot of it's unknown at this point in some ways. But you do a wonderful job, and since you're Australian, I also have to kind of give props to Oz, because Australia has really played a significant role in changing and offering new opportunities for the culture of DMT, because of both its very rich psychedelic trance culture and its botany. So I'd love to hear a little bit about the role that Australia has played, in something that you've studied and grew up in, and came of age in the era of the dance parties, et cetera, and knew a lot of these kind of characters and what the scene was about. But I'd love to hear a little bit about Australia's role in the kind of DMT renaissance.
Well, of course, Australia's had a key role in this phenomenon, certainly since the 90s, even going back to the early 90s. And, there's a chapter in the book that deals with this flourishing. And there, of course, there's much more to be said and written about that. But the chapter essentially deals with the emergence of the DMT smoking blend, Changa, which is referred to as Changa, and the backstory of frontier beta testing and backyard experiments that had gone on with adventurous young people finding that their backyards were full of potential sources of DMT, because, of course, Australia's many species of acacia sources of DMT be extracted from those species. And so it's a story of this discovery that Australia is effectively a national floral symbol, is actually a source of DMT, and that has been a source of celebration for a great many of Aussies. And so, yes, this story of you know, underground research and beta testing that has you know, eventuated in the fact that you can turn up to dance festivals and smell a very distinct bouquet associated with these blends that have been optimized for more recreational use, although I use the word recreational loosely because many people take this very, very seriously, but it's an optimized use that is optimized for more social and public experimentations.
Well, you know, just since we're on the topic of Australian underground culture, electronic music culture, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this, as you know, I mean, you're both of your books about Psytrance, Global Tribe, and Technomad, Global Raving Countercultures, emphasize the global. And indeed, that's one of the most interesting things about, or I think significant things about that scene, is that they're, you know, if you look around at popular culture or different kind of dance music forms or musical forms, there really aren't that many things that are really that global. Even hip-hop, which is all over the place, gets translated and, you know, rephrased and revoiced in different languages. So while as an overall genre it's global, it doesn't people aren't listening to the same things. There's something about a kind of global dimension of that culture that seems really significant, but of course at the same time, every local scene has its own flavor, its own blend, its own kind of balance of elements of spirituality and hedonism and art and technology and musical styles, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think is unique or singular, or what characterizes Australian psychedelic dance culture?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's probably characterized by its outdoor nature, its distinct bush environments. It's striking that even though we are an island continent, most of these events do not transpire on the coast, but they're inland and normally in the hinterlands of cities. There's also events that I've experienced in the desert, like Earth Dream and other and anti-nuclear industry events, as well as psychedelic trance events. So they're quite a distinctive. It's distinctive by its diversity. In terms of its global aspect, it's obviously it's increasingly in some ways cheaper to arrive at Australia from the Northern Hemisphere, but it's been traditionally a very, very difficult place to get to. And so the events haven't been anywhere near as sort of global in scope as, for instance, the Boom Festival in Portugal, which to me is the premier global event in the psychedelic visionary arts calendar. That's an event where you will... you know, you can share a dance floor with people from over 100 different countries. So, but while you won't get that in Australia, you will get a strong sense of ritual and indigenous culture. We've just had the Rainbow Serpent Festival in Australia, which is characterized by its welcome to country opening ceremony, which is an indigenous many indigenous custodians and peoples from across the continent put together a purification ritual that effectively the logic of which is to legitimize the presence of those who are, who are there and their occupation of that country for that duration. That, those kinds of rituals are quite common in Australia.
I mean, since we're talking about electronic dance music, can you go through about the intricate connections between DMT and the music, both in terms of how people kind of weave their experiences into the music and how musicians themselves are inspired by these experiences? What is that resonance about? What is it about the genre of psytrance or the use of electronics and the kind of ethos, the kind of environmental ambient dimension of these sounds and soundscapes? What is it about that resonates or that seems so appropriate, so simpatico with the DMT experience, in the words of the musicians that you've talked to so extensively over the years?
Yeah, I guess one of my longstanding interests is to understand, get closer to the nature of the vibe. And I guess in some ways, I'm a vibologist. And so this is the sensation, the socio-aesthetic that those who are drawn to electronic dance music cultures and other dance-centered formations. It's this terminology that people use to understand and recognize an optimal state. And for me, it's been interesting to determine the sensory technologies, the assemblage of sensory technologies that are developed and optimized and manipulated to augment this socio-aesthetic state. And I've been interested in how antigens and psychedelics are implicated in these technologies, in the wider spiritual technology of events and festivals that enable these experiences. And of course, DMT is I think significant to that in terms of the development of psychedelic electronica. And I've often used the phrase remixticism to refer to the way that DJs, producers, and the whole assemblage of producers involved in reproducing the vibe have for instance, certainly in the case of DJs and producers, how vocal samples from a range of sources, whether they be films or TV series, Altered Statesmen, computer games, podcasts, whatever, are deployed programmed into tracks to evoke significant states, and often in the breakdowns or at the beginning and the end of tracks to evoke or even send up certain non-ordinary states of consciousness. I'm fascinated with the way that this takes part in the wider assemblage of techniques to produce and affect non-ordinary states of consciousness.
I'll say, and along with the way in which culture and media help propagate the qualities, or at least the interest in these altered states, individuals have also been really important too. Of course, you can't really tell the story of DMT in the modern world without talking about both Terence McKenna and Rick Strassman, in terms of, in fact, almost you have like an interesting and important question about how much the stories that these significant and influential individuals have about the substance, about what it means, about where, how to think about it, and how influential that has been, not only on the way we talk about this stuff, but the way people actually experience it. And I'm sure you've thought a lot about that issue. People let's hold off on the entity question for a moment, but it certainly seems to be, it's very significant that people associate their expectations of DMT, their experiences of DMT, with things that, say, Terrence McKenna has said in his extremely colorful, very vivid and evocative raps about his experiences. Can you say a little bit about the role that these guys, both McKenna and maybe we can get to Strassman in the next question, but the role that these guys have played in shaping what the meaning of this substance is?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating question, and I'm sure that there, that's possibly a book or someone's thesis dissertation project in its own right. The question of how much Terrence's extemporizations on the machine elves of hyperspace has certainly in the 90s impacted and shaped and guided or provided the kind of conceptual sort of resources for those who've entered these otherwise unknown states. And certainly to look at Terrence's own developments and how he, applied different ideas and theories to his own visitations and his own contact experiences over his life. That didn't change. I mean, he was, quite flexible and moved from different positions. So there's not exactly one position. I think, as you know, anyone who is attempting to research the life of Terrence McKenna got a lot of work on their hands.
Yeah, it's true. I talked to a fellow who at least at that point was writing a biography, and he was a very nice guy, and he had done some biography before, but he didn't know what he was in for, and I didn't know what. I said, "Hey, man, I don't know how to break this to you, but this is going to be a wild ride for you. A lot of twists and turns ahead." Rick Strassman, of course, is another figure. His book, The Spirit Molecule, Before Yours, is the most kind of significant book about DMT, and really, really impacted popular culture and introduced a whole notion that DMT is endogenous, that it emerges from the pineal gland. There's a whole story there. I'd love to hear you kind of say what that story is, and then talk about the fact that in some sense it's kind of a myth, or at least a speculation that was then received as truth and widely spread as such. And that too tells us something about this strange liminal place between science and psychology and spirituality and folklore that DMT seems to kind of open up just by its very nature. And Strassman's whole book, where he's, a scientist dealing with these things that kind of undermine the scientific worldview, and he himself shifts in and out of being a straight-laced researcher and a searching Buddhist. And it's a fascinating story because it reflects so much about this ambivalence or this strange kind of liminal character that DMT has.
Yes, of course, his story is also fascinating because, of course, he provides us with a range of conceptual resources and across religious traditions because, of course, Rick has moved from his Buddhist faith he's basically a returnee to Judaism in his recent book. And so one of the chapters deals with the implications of how the basic meme of the spirit molecule has essentially left the clinic to take on a life of its own. And that meme is, of course, his speculations that arrive, I guess, for many people in as sort of truth claims that the pineal gland is the brain's production source of DMT, and that the pineal gland releases DMT at key moments in the life cycle of birth and death, and with the influence from Buddhist ideas of reincarnation, that it's instrumental in sort of enabling the soul's flow into a new life. So one of the ways that this has fascinated me is that the idea has, you know, left the clinic and taken up residence in the scripts of horror film script writers. And there's a number of recent horror films that I sort of document in the book, like Banshee Chapter and a range of other ones, where this idea of the DMT gland has enabled script writers to deal with long-standing themes like possession and reanimation in new ways. That DMT provides a new sort of a tool or vehicle to address these long-standing issues.
Yeah, I really appreciate how you've done such a thorough job of hunting, the vast archive of contemporary popular culture to find these tales and uses and sort of transformed appearances of DMT as a plot device, as a kind of space of fantasy, as an emerging culture. But it's interesting that you talk about horror films because, you know, on the one hand, as you report very thoroughly, there's many people these days who treat DMT as a profoundly sacred compound, that the ritual of taking it, whether smoking it directly or through the mediation of ayahuasca, is deeply tied in with their spirituality, a spirituality that we can look, you know, we can go back and look at certain indigenous sources that or indigenous groups that have been using DMT and the way in which they think about it, and then sort of discovering or recreating other kind of spiritual modes. And at the same time, then that makes sense. It totally makes sense given the phenomenology that would be the sacred reading, would be one response to DMT. And at the same time, the horror writers aren't just, you know, they're not just goofing. There's something kind of like appropriate in some way about their reimagination of this as well. And so we're dealing with something that has, which in some sense I think is probably makes it even more sacred in a way, is that it has this profound kind of ambivalence. It's a vehicle of light and a vehicle, at least in our imaginations, of a kind of horror or dark side or Lovecraftian dimension as well. And we find that even in psytrance, where you get into horror trance and that kind of, there's already a sort of question about how to sort of engage the dark side, even in the context of something that many people think of as being spiritual or sacred. How do you think your way through that sort of ambivalence around the sacred?
Well, yeah, another good question. I think a large part of the book is an attempt to address the this sort of unfolding of this cultural history of ambivalence that we have towards DMT and other tryptamines and psychedelics in general, but DMT most particular. And I mean that's present in the wide understanding of, on the one hand, that DMT is dangerous, and on the other hand, that as I think Terrence McKenna said, that its real danger is to to expose you to death by astonishment, and then of course Strassman's idea that that the spirit molecule is the brain's own. That DMT is the brain's own psychedelic. And we see that ambivalence manifest itself in various ways. And I saw it recently in watching the first season of the Wachowskis series Sense8, which I'm sure many of your listeners have seen, and they'll know that that DMT plays a strong role in this series, which I think the first or second episode has a group of people smoking DMT, which was being introduced as a source of potential truth, transcendence, and transformation, I'm quoting. And yet, immediately after smoking DMT, everyone in the room, almost everyone in the room dies from gun wounds and gun bullets and knife wounds, which is a complete misrepresentation of that, you know, the potentials of that situation, but yet provides a very good example of this cultural ambivalence.
Yeah, same thing as in the Gaspar Noé or Noé film, Enter the Void, where you also have that additional, you get some of the Strassman lore, you get the connection between DMT and the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the idea of the bardo, and of course that becomes the structuring device for the whole film. But once again, we see our hero smoke some DMT, and then he goes to do a drug deal and then gets killed in a toilet. And so there is this weird a sense about it, and I think that it's partly, in a way, my question was kind of a setup, because I think sometimes in the contemporary mind space, especially with the sort of the New Age and behind that Christianity, is that people often think of the sacred or the spiritual as being, you know, the realm of light, of the good, of the beautiful. But there's another element there. That's sort of an aspect of it for sure. But there's also what, Rudolf Otto, the great, theologian and sort of religious theorist, talked about in terms of the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, which is this idea that the holy or the sacred or the numinous is a mystery that's at once terrifying and repelling and attractive and fascinating. And it's precisely actually that ambivalence itself, which I think has a lot of the sacred potential, that's actually partly what's driving the sort of deeper investigation, why people return, why people wonder, why they, kind of come back to the thing. Right. But it's interesting. What have you found in terms of cultural objects, films, recordings, that really more captures the sort of, if you will, light side, the transcendent, the liberating, the cosmic, the healing aspects that people also associate with DMT?
Well, that's a good question. I think that there's probably a heavy attitude towards producing films that are more H.P. Lovecraft inspired. Yeah. And yet, I think Graham Hancock's working on in some interesting areas. His novel, I think it's a double novel called Entangled. We haven't seen Tangled. We haven't seen the second one. I think in the psychedelic sensibility that we see in psychedelic electronic era that is very evident on dance floors around the world, we see that. Transformative implications and potential of DMT performed. But I just wanted to also point out that, just talking about fascination and this outlaw sensibility that has a sense of the sacred associated with it because it's dangerous and outlawed. And I think that's one of the reasons why, William Burroughs was so and remains such a source of fascination. And of course, he himself was drawn to the Amazon. He was drawn to ayahuasca, yahe, in the 50s and early 50s, and then later experimented at the turn of the 60s with DMT. He was drawn to the substances in ways that are fascinating, and of course then we're drawn to his evocations of his experiences with these these substances and these adventures. And of course, we have the key text, the Yahweh letters that are letters between him and Ginsberg. Came, I think, it was published in 63, and provide us with an example of the cut up effect. And for anyone who's like me, was exposed to that book for the first time, it was quite an extraordinary attempt to understand where he was getting to, because of course we weren't provided with the introduction that to the more recent version of the Yahweh letters, where the Burroughsian scholar Harris provides us with a beautiful introduction to where we recognize that, in fact, this was an example of a cut-up technique, and that, in fact, more to the point, Burroughs, unlike my initial interpretation and that of many others, had an essentially transformational experience with Yahweh back in the 50s, and it was he basically said it was it, and it was it was the real thing.
Yeah, and you find that in the, and then you can sort of see that, read that backwards, or read it through so many of his literary works, you can sort of see that sort of ayahuasca space, that hyperspace, accessed through the cut up, or in the contemporary terms, the remixology of dance music producers, that there's something weirdly modern, in a sense, or even postmodern, hypermodern about DMT, that it's not, even though it is a sacred substance in indigenous contexts, there it almost seems like chomping at the bit to leap into our contemporary moment, even as it asks or demands sort of puts it sort of in your face mystery. This isn't mystery like the spooky unknown dark mountain that no one has ever accessed through the trees. It's mystery that's in your face that you can't understand, you can't wrap your head around, because it's so astonishing. And of course, the ultimate question here, which we've kept at bay, and then we only have about 10 minutes left, is this question of entities that a lot of people experience, at least see sort of cavorting characters, and whether we call them elves or not. And again, if you go back to the 60s, you can see similar images before Terence McKenna, famously named the machine elves. And indeed, if you go through the accounts in Strassman or on Arrowhead, et cetera, you find a very large, a healthy percentage of people have these encounters that are so real and so bizarre, and yet so kind of hard to deny on some phenomenological level, that it raises these deeper questions that are totally challenge Western modern secular ways of thinking about the world. And you do a wonderful job of covering the range of ideas that people come out of from these around these experiences, whether they think that there's some kind of dimensional space that's opened up so that true contact is happening, to people who come up with very interesting, more neurological information-based models for understanding why we would have those kinds of experiences in these particular kinds of altered states, which also have a lot going for them. After doing all this work, how did it change you? Like, when you started doing this research, you might have had some idea of what you could talk about in terms of the ontology of, or the nature, the true nature of these kinds of entities that people reported. And then after reading all these reports and writing through it and thinking through the possibilities, what shifted, or did something shift in the way you think about these things?
Well, I think this project really, in a way, amplified my initial interest with liminality. And this idea of being in between, because of course the DMT experience is a quintessentially liminal experience, and I guess the exposure to entities, which, as you say, they're you know, a manifest range of these contact phenomena that are reported in the DMT experience, and that these entities or disincarnate beings have a range of motivations. Many experienced users will have, you know, continuing ongoing relationships with these entities, and as you say, there is a range of explanations that I attempt to cover in the book, although I think that there could be, you know, clearly there's a scope for a book that would address this theme in particular. But just going back to liminality, I think that, yeah, it amplified an existing fascination I have with the idea of the threshold and the threshold is you know, a powerful space of potential, and that one of the potentialities of this, and of course when you have a threshold, you have a transit, you have a travel, you have a sense of you know, being mobilized across a threshold and achieving the other side, and then there's a return. So there's a rite of passage like process associated with this experience. And I think that one of the commonalities of this passage is that the travelers, the contactees will come out of that experience with a potentially transformed understanding of their own consciousness, a transformed understanding from the understanding that the brain is the producer of consciousness, to an understanding that we are, or our brains are, like a receiving station, receiving consciousness. And that, of course, is, you know, it's nothing new. When people are exposed to this potential transition, they, you know, may act like initiates who have, you know, joined a sort of wider you know, community of understanding.
And then what are some of the things that you found that people, that most intrigued you about how people are sort of engaging the entities or wanting to, or the, are they creating rituals? Are they making art? Are they attempting to speak for these beings? Like how, what's some of the more interesting expressions of this encounter that you found?
Well, I think that if you look at one of the most important web portals for anything associated with DMT, that's the DM, it's a DMT Nexus. That's DMT's dash Nexus. You'll find things like the hyperspace lexicon, which is a fascinating source of new terminology and nomenclature that those who are experienced with the hyperspace and its occupants and its various authentic worlds have attempted to provide a lexicon, or have provided a lexicon, which includes reference to a range of entities. And I think that for our listeners, anyone interested in how the range of entities that are being documented in these spaces are finding their way into cyberspace, that's probably one of the first ports of calls. You'll see how, I mean, I describe in the book how relationships with entities are a little like, and these sort of developing frameworks of understandings around these entities are a little like, you know, role-playing games, a little like characters in role-playing games, and that one's interactions with these entities appear to manifest in similar ways.
Yeah, and it also raises the sort of issue of fictionality, and in a strong way, not to say, oh, these are just fictions, they're just stories, but rather that the opposite, that we start to see the way that fictions work as a kind of co-creative of reality, And that seems to, again, show how DMT, while, you know, there's a tendency when we talk about drugs to just talk about drugs and the drug culture and the things that are about the drug. And it's harder sometimes to see the connections between much larger things that are happening in the culture. But I think this point as well is really significant. If you look at how people are inventing new religious modes, or people are pushing the boundaries of role-playing games or of cosplay or of, you know, crafting alternative identities and having them work in social space or work in virtual space, that there's sort of these resonating levels of similar phenomena, even though in one case it's about this sort of dangerous and scheduled drug and it's kind of underground. But in other ways, even though it's so extreme and unusual vis-a-vis normal reality, modern reality, not necessarily old reality, traditional reality, but by modern reality standards. But at the same time, we see significance that goes beyond the boundaries of the compound itself.
Yeah, indeed. And,
I was just going to say, I think we're wrapping it up here. So I wanted to, you know, thank you again for Mystery School in Hyperspace. It's a terrific work. And, I'm just curious, are you good to going to a lot of festivals? You're going to be giving talks on this stuff? What's the next step with the book?
Well, I'll be back in the U.S. a couple of times this year. So there's a lot of potential for that. I need to thank North Atlantic Books. They did a wonderful job with the production of this tome, and I must also thank Dennis McKenna, who wrote the foreword, and the many visionary artists who provided work, donated material, including Bo Dealey, who's provided this wonderful cover image, and the many people who supported me throughout this project. Thank you.
Well, that's very kind to say. I like that. It's like you're getting a, you know, like the Psychedelic Book of the Year Award. anyway, thanks so much for joining me on Expanding Mind, Graham. All right, from me to all you out there, keep your minds open.